portfolio to get it bigger.
Now she has these talks.
Sort of long-term security relationship, this is SOFA type talks. Those are hers too.
Those are hers too. That's quite a portfolio. I think we're ready. Everybody's okay. Quiet. Everybody's so disciplined this morning.
Good morning.
In fact, I would have set this up around the table, but we have an event later this afternoon that has to be this way. But we want to welcome you. My name is Daniel Serwer. I'm the Vice President for Peace and Stability Operations here at the U.S. Institute of Peace. And Iraq is one of my primary concerns, and Charlie Reese is half of the Reese family working in Iraq and holds the economic portfolio, which we have not had so much opportunity to examine here at USIP, and I particularly welcome this opportunity to have a look at the economic situation, what progress has been made, what the main challenges are. We hear sporadically about these things, and it's my hope that Charlie will bring us the kind of on-the-ground realism that we need in Washington about the situation. So without further ado, I want to welcome Charlie, whom I've known for a long time. I can't tell you when we actually first met. I know Marcy a little bit better, actually. Jim, please come on in. Lots of seats.
Are there?
Yeah, there are. But I think I'll express right up front the gratitude all of us feel that the Reese family has committed itself so fully to Iraq and the U.S. mission there. Charlie?
Thank you very much, Dan. It's great to see so many old friends and so forth. I have a text, and I would normally just speak off the cuff to a group of this size and hope to answer questions and have a discussion afterwards. The reason I have a text, though, is that for us, if I do this, we can put it on the website and get a bigger audience, in a sense, for the points that I was going to make. And so forgive me for reading. I hope it isn't too boring, and maybe we'll stop from time to time for digressions if you'll allow me. Great pleasure to be here. I've always had enormous respect for the U.S. Institute for Peace and the contributions that you have made to transition in East and Central Europe and for the countries that you have done so much work, the USIP has done, Dan personally has done so much work, are now partners in our Euro-Atlantic institutions. My position in Baghdad is focused on transition and is a what I like to think is a one-of-a-kind job at a one-of-a-kind kind of time. It exists because we're changing our relationship with Iraq, and as we do, our assistance in particular has to be in transition. In general, we're moving from infrastructure, from the bricks and mortar projects that we did for the first few years, to assistance that promotes long-term economic development, ensures democratic governance, and leverages Iraq's own resources to get more bang for the buck. So today I'm going to try and tell you how, and I'm going to focus on what we are calling the civilian surge, the personnel that we put in key positions to help the Iraqi government at national and provincial level to make maximum use of its own resources. But first, a little background. I sometimes say that Iraq now has a democratic government, but still has the remnants of a Stalinist economy. The economy is in such a state as a result of the decades of mismanagement under Saddam, compounded by the disastrous war with Iran and the debt that Iraq incurred to fight it. Central control of the economy increased in the 1990s when, in response to sanctions, Iraq built additional inefficient state-run industries to substitute for imported goods no longer available. And of course, famously enough, the Oil for Food program created the public distribution system, a system to provide monthly allocations of food in kind to every Iraqi. And the PDS today is the largest single expenditure item in Iraq's national budget. So in all, Iraq is a country used to having resources directed from the top down, from the national government in Baghdad to state institutions, public enterprises, and the provinces. The coalition forces that ousted Saddam found critical infrastructure had been ruined after decades of neglect and essential resources lacking because of corruption and mismanagement. For that reason, much of our initial assistance was directed to bricks and mortar projects to help restore services vital to the Iraqi people, reconstruction in the concrete, literally, sense of the word. We focused on projects that would get the lights on, make basic health care available, ensure energy and transportation security, and get the water running. That was the right thing and the necessary thing to do at the time to get the infrastructure up and running. But now we think it's time to change direction. When I took this job last July, the international zone, where we all live and work, was experiencing near daily volleys of mortars and rockets. Other parts of Iraq were experiencing the same. But as the military surge took hold, the threats lessened and economic activity picked up, slowly but measurably. There were brave early entrepreneurs seeking to take back their neighborhoods and government institutions. The security situation was and is extremely fragile. Effective ministers, deputy ministers, and senior officials still risk kidnapping or targeted assassinations. But gradually, we saw that the military surge had given us an opening to make important progress on economic and governance issues, if we could direct our resources fast, where they would have maximum effect. We therefore needed to change our focus from bricks and mortar to giving our Iraqi partners the technical assistance that they needed. Notice also that I said partners. Iraq's national government, the national budget, doubled from $20 billion in 2004 to $41 billion in 2007, and the budget just passed is $48 billion for 2008, largely as a result of dramatically higher oil prices. Iraq is now making its own investment decisions to address the major challenges it faces. We decided it was time to use our assistance dollars as leverage in a productive partnership. How? By addressing some of the critical economic priorities that would bolster stability and improve the Iraqis' ability to govern. If we could do that, bring even a modest economic revival to neighborhoods now experiencing greater security, the gains of the military surge would be less likely to be undermined by still active insurgents looking for ways to create chaos. One of the major challenges Iraq faces is unemployment and its close cousin, underemployment. Officially, unemployment is 18%, but underemployment is much higher, perhaps 40 or 50% with the two together. Employment opportunities give Iraqis a stake in their society, in its stability, in its economic growth and democratic government. Last fall, as the military surge expanded, local Iraqis stepped up to provide security for economic infrastructure in their communities. The Concerned Local Citizens program was designed to give them support. We are now working with the Iraqi government to find them opportunities for follow-on training and employment, whether in the public or private sector. We also established a community stabilization program to provide short-term jobs, bolster essential services such as trash removal, offer vocational training, and provide microgrants, particularly in recently stabilized areas. And a pilot civilian service corps program launched by U.S. forces will provide jobs and vocational training to Iraqis who undertake reconstruction and infrastructure development projects in their neighborhoods. But the long-term solution must be economic growth and a market economy that promotes and sustains employment. Economic growth, in turn, requires investment, domestic and international. Recent security gains have brought a surge in Iraqi business confidence. A December survey of Iraqi business leaders showed that 84% of them believe that security had been better in 2007 than 2006. More than three-quarters of the business owners anticipated growth in the national economy over the next 2 years, and almost half believe that sales will increase in the next 6 months. As a result of that kind of optimism and its expression in the real world, the IMF is projecting 7% GDP growth for 2008. But to make that happen, Iraq needs to undertake key reforms. Iraqis need to restructure their banking industry to provide for better conditions for private banks and to increase lending of all sorts. They need to privatize unprofitable state-owned industries. They need to maximize profitability in the energy sector, and above all, they need to attract investment. Let me give you an example of how tough that can be. Last summer in 120-degree heat, I'm not looking for sympathy here, but it's true, I toured an Iraqi electrical transformer factory. The plant leaders led me to a locked box, carefully closed each night to protect it from dust, which housed the factory's precious 1980s-era computer. One of the employees showed me how he nursed along another piece of critical equipment, carefully rewiring it whenever it broke. These are industries that will need significant investment if they are to restructure and be competitive. Now, Iraq's government institutions also need to develop their human resources, a critical commodity for development. The more effective the Iraqi government is at all levels, the more confidence Iraqi citizens will have in the democratic process. The Iraqi government must demonstrate that it is listening and responding to the needs of its citizens. How can you tell if a government is listening? By seeing it spend resources on the problems that you care about. In 2006, the Iraqi government spent only 22% of its capital investment budget. Officials needed training in procurement, contracting, anti-corruption safeguards, and technology to do better. We took on those surge challenges with a toolbox of programs specially tailored through USAID and the embassy's Iraq Transition Assistance Office to complement others offered by the combat brigades. And we decided to surge civilian personnel with specific skills that Iraq needs. First, we expanded our provincial reconstruction teams. When the president announced the surge, there were only 10 PRTs. Now, a little bit more than a year later, the number has more than doubled to 25. PRTs operate in provinces as diverse as Nineveh, Anbar, Babel, Al, and Basra. Some are embedded with military forces. They ride in Humvees and MRAPs, and they've taken fire, quite often, in fact. But they also interact every day with local government and non-governmental leaders, with businessmen and farmers. They are at the forefront of our outreach to the Iraqi people, and is such a critical element in the counterinsurgency. Who are these people? Well, they're volunteers, and their numbers have reached nearly 800, ranging in age from the mid-20s to the other side of 60. Some are, like me, career diplomats. Some come from other parts of the U.S. government, some from the military, some from the private sector. So if I put them together in this room, you might meet a farmer from Ohio, banking expert from Washington, a veterinarian from Tennessee, city planner from Illinois. And if you want to see a real interagency process that works, come spend some time with one of our PRTs. And because, hey, Jonathan, how are you? And because this was a fast-moving situation, we gave them resources. Again, our goal was to use our money as leverage to partner with the Iraqis to consolidate the political and economic gains from the surge. We established quick response funds for the PRTs, giving the teams the flexibility they needed to get projects moving rapidly. We were asking the PRTs to identify ways to help local officials invest in their communities and put a stake in to get it going. And they are. Our PRT in Muthana transformed a primary school serving a poor rural community into a modern four-classroom school building. They installed rooftop solar panels to power small heat and dust-resistant laptops with innovative educational software in Arabic. The education ministry takes it from there, providing the teachers, books, and the operating budget of the school. The Muthana team is expanding the one laptop per child concept to a series of model schools, including an orphanage and an all-girls school throughout the province. Each school will have 10 to 20 computers and will be paired with a counterpart U.S. elementary school to encourage interaction and relationships between Iraqi and American children. Now, since 2005, the Iraq's central government has transferred some budget resources directly to the provinces. It amounted to over $2 billion in 2008 and will be over $3 billion in 2007 and will be over $3 billion in 2008. PRTs have worked with provincial authorities identifying needs, accelerating their spending, and making contracting more professional and work plans more rigorous. USAID programs have provided critical technical assistance, building the skills and capacity of local government. USAID sent 37 experts to assist local government officials in the provinces in strengthening governance, public finance, city planning, and engineering. USAID's local governance program teaches officials how to develop projects, budget and contract for projects that address local needs. That means they are able to spend the money now allocated by the national government in Baghdad. And through the Community Action Program, USAID contractors work at the grassroots level to enable local Iraqi citizens to have a voice in their government. Our goal is to build ability. The better the ability of the government, whether local or national, to respond to the needs of the citizen, the more credible and more responsive Iraq's democratic system becomes. So we have the PRTs and USAID programs building capacity at the local level. What are we doing at the national level? As we surged our PRTs, we decided to dedicate an additional 75 experts to building capacity in the key ministries. 18 are working solely on energy issues alone. Others are working with the Ministry of Agriculture, the Ministry of Health, the Prime Minister's Office. The day I left, we had 70 of the 75 already on the ground. We're assessing their initial impact now. But in some areas, like health, they have already brought a substantial improvement in the Ministry of Health's effectiveness and engagement. It's hard to overemphasize, though, the difficulty of doing this. Many of the ministries are in areas that are hard for us to visit due to security threats. Last week, I went with one of our health advisors to visit a primary health care clinic, one of the first to open out of the 140 that we are building. The men and women doctors on the staff face tough odds: lack of electricity and water, mechanical difficulties, shortages of key supplies. But they did not lack patients. Security in the neighborhood had improved, and there was a long line of patients waiting for care. And they also didn't lack enthusiasm. The expertise our ministerial capacity advisors offer complements USAID's technical assistance program on public management. That program, called TATWIR, focuses on key areas: budgeting, procurement, human resources, strategic planning. Scheduled to run through July of 2009, it has already trained over 7,000 civil servants and plans to train an additional 14,000 over the next 18 months. Our assistance is in transition, but what's next? We think we need to build on our investment. We put significant resources into bricks and mortar. Now we have increased security and an Iraqi government ready to budget its own resources for construction. The best assistance we can give is expertise, making the Iraqi government and the and its economy more effective, more flexible, more dynamic. That's why we will be proposing the reprogramming of some bricks and mortar resources to support anti-corruption initiatives, farmers cooperatives, small enterprise development, local governance, banking reform, and technical assistance for the Ministry of Finance and the Central Bank. These days, we're less about reconstructing plant and equipment and more about constructing a skilled workforce, a responsive government, and an economy that is self-sustaining and attractive to investors. That's our challenge as we redefine our partnership with Iraq and reevaluate how we best can assist in the future. We've redirected our assistance and surged our civilian advisors in the PRTs and in Baghdad. We've done it rapidly to take advantage of the security gains that remain recent and fragile. But make no mistake, it's tough for experts to visit the local ministries and officials. They face security threats and restrictions. Iraqi officials themselves are targets for those who would prefer an unstable, dangerous, economically uncompetitive Iraq to the Iraq that we're trying to build. The improvements we have made are reversible. The good news is that Iraq has significant energy resources and a growing income that it is ready to spend, and its people have a solid appreciation of how valuable its resources can be if used correctly. That's why Iraq is also our commitment to technical assistance it needs now. And it has the commitment of the international community as well. The UN is increasing its presence in Iraq, as are some European partners. Donors are coordinating assistance with each other and with the Iraqi government, the Iraqi government's own development priorities through the International Compact with Iraq. Economic transition is, of course, just one part of our effort in Iraq. But as we've seen over the last few months, it's essential to Iraq's broader transition to democratic governance and political reconciliation. Iraq has held national elections, and at the national level, its government is facing the need to make tough compromises to pass legislation, execute a budget, provide services to all Iraqis, regardless of background or political affiliation, and to fight corruption. This year, Iraq is scheduled to hold provincial elections, a key step, although the provincial powers law recently passed by the Council of Representatives was vetoed and needs to be reconsidered due to constitutional issues raised by the Presidency Council. But that debate, too, shows a constitutional process that is working, and in a way unimaginable under the previous regime. Every day brings new challenges and often disappointments. The scale of the economic challenges in Iraq is immense. The Iraqis themselves are now spending more of their own, more on their own development than we are, and the economy is starting to recover. Inshallah, we can keep going in this way. Thank you.
Thank you, Charlie. What I would suggest is that you take questions from there.
That sounds good.
I'll just add a word for my part that when I was in Baghdad recently with Rand, we heard a great deal about interest in provincial elections, something that was actually quite surprising because Iraqis in the past have been uninterested in the provincial level of government. And I attribute this in large part to the success of the PRTs in moving money out of Baghdad, getting provincial councils that can actually plan and program projects, and all of a sudden people are looking around and saying, well, these provincial councils might be worth being on, and maybe it was a mistake to boycott them when we did. So I think there's a very visible political impact at the moment of some of what the PRTs have been engaged in. The floor is open for questions. The microphone is here, and Paul Hughes will introduce himself.
Good day. I'm Paul Hughes from the U.S. Institute of Peace. The question I have relates actually to a little bit of history. When the Marshall Plan was conceived, the first requirement was for the Europeans to come together, organize themselves, assess their needs, and then issue a report to the U.S. on what they thought was needed to kickstart their economic rebirth. Has there been any sort of effort made by the Iraqi government to form some kind of organization that would do this kind of assessment? Because we've heard so much about how there is still some distrust among the various elements. And what the United States appears to be doing is focusing most of its efforts at the provincial level. We would like to see something at the national level, but is there something, a counterpart to your position at the Iraqi national level that is actually assessing Iraq's needs that everybody, all the Iraqis can agree to, and then issuing that to us so that we know what kind of aid they need, or are we setting the priorities for Iraqi economic rebirth?
Thanks, Paul. The answer is yes and no. The Iraqis do have the normal panoply of ministries, including a Ministry of Planning, and they have a very active, able, and imaginative Deputy Prime Minister, Barham Saleh, for responsible for the economic situation. They have developed their own national development strategy in 2005, and of course in the compact last summer, they committed themselves to a whole series of reforms designed to create a more private sector oriented economy, and a lot of that is describing reality. It isn't just sort of boxes on an organizational chart, but in the past, in the first phases of this, in 2003, 2004, 2005, there wasn't really an Iraqi government standing. And in those days, we decided what they needed, and we built it. And it's only now, as we come to deliver these projects, the Iraqis say, well, you know, that really wasn't what we needed, or we needed something else, or we need something additional. And at this point, we're saying, well, I'm sorry, the bricks and mortar period of our reconstruction is ending. You have lots of money. We'll help you figure out how to spend your own money to fix those kinds of things. And the good news is that they have absorbed that message, and they are charging off in various directions. The health ministry wants to build a whole series of hospitals. Some of our people say, well, better spend your money on primary level care clinics. And we built actually the 140 primary health care clinics, and there's a tension between where do you put your personnel resources, where do you put the medical supplies and equipment, where do you put maintenance and other kinds of money. But it's ultimately it's their money in their country, and they are starting to stand up and make those decisions, which in some respects we sort of say, well, I'm not sure we agree with that, but they're their decisions, and it's their money that's backing them up. Effectively, though, what we are trying to do is help them work through these kinds of issues, and the international communities as well. A central problem for the success of their economy will be how they use their energy resources and wealth. And there, the international community has a very keen interest in seeing them comply with the compact commitment to develop a national energy strategy. And, you know, you might say, oh, well, it's simple. You just pump all this oil out and sell it in the world market. It isn't simple at all. There are questions about how do you use the associated gas? Do you develop it for export? Do you develop it for industry? Do you develop it for power? What kind of pricing relationships do you have between the oil ministry and the electricity ministry? And what kind of priority do you place on large-scale power production versus distributed small-scale and so forth? And they have to step up and make those decisions themselves. We are not going to dictate them.
Let me challenge you, Charlie, on one point, and that's this question of our early emphasis on infrastructure and hardware. You said it was appropriate at the time and that what's appropriate now is something different, but do you really think that's right? I mean, I think we spent far too much in the initial period on hardware and infrastructure, and far too little on building Iraqi capacity. I'd have, in retrospect, I'd have let them fix their own power plants with bubble gum and aluminum foil, and not worried about building the most modern plants on Earth, which is what we did, actually. I talked to the engineers about it, and we were trying to build the most modern plants on Earth in Iraq. Wasn't that a mistake in retrospect?
Dan, you know, I've come to Washington this week to describe what we're doing, and almost every meeting I've had, somebody wants me to talk about what we used to do.
Okay.
And I wasn't involved. I mean, this is not a personal thing. I mean, I think that our focus now is in trying to solidify the gains that we are now seeing and push ahead. I really can't speak to what was done in the past, except as a contrast to what we're doing now.
Fair enough. Rent.
Rendell Rahim, United States Institute of Peace. How many questions am I allowed, Dan?
For you, Rend, there's great tolerance, but don't overstep.
I have a couple of specific questions and one general one. I'll start with the general one. It's a follow-up a little bit on Paul's question. What are the mechanisms that the embassy in Baghdad and all the experts and so on, what are the mechanisms that they have for interfacing with the Iraqi government, whether it's Barham Saleh or the ministries? And is there some kind of joint committee, joint commission? At what level does this dialogue take place? And to what extent does the embassy and the experts at the embassy and yourself included have to facilitate or influence the progress of the Iraqi government in the economic sector? That's a sort of general, it's a kind of processes and mechanisms question. The other two questions are, the Iraqi government has just recently signed 5 technical services agreements with the 5 major oil companies.
I don't think they've signed unless that happened in the last 24 hours. They're planning on signing them.
Or planning
on
signing.
They're negotiating them this week in Amman, but I don't think
they've
signed
them. There was, I think, a letter of intent to sign them, and they're supposed to do it this week. Is it realistic to expect these large companies to go into Iraq now and work on what is very badly needed, technical services? And the second question is...
That's the third question.
The third question. I'm trying to camouflage.
Budget accounting.
Third question is, the issue of jobs is essential to security. Mm-hmm. And while we can work gradually on building up other sectors and so on, but it seems to me, and this was part of the impression Dan and I got, was that we need a job creation program very quickly, especially given the sahwas and so on. One of the sectors that is that employs large numbers of people at fairly low skill levels is the housing sector, which is also extremely needed in Iraq. And it has a ripple effect throughout the economy. And yet we don't hear very much from the government about doing something about the housing sector. The government has huge tracts of land. Most of Iraq is actually owned by the government. And they could do something about it if they could get going. This would really be a quick fix. I want to know your view about this.
Rand, let us give Charlie a chance to reply. That's
thank you.
Okay. On mechanisms and process, we, in some ways, Iraq looks like an ordinary embassy in that we have staff from a number of agencies, and they have the responsibility for dealing with the ministries that they would normally deal with. So I have an agriculture counselor who deals with the Ministry of Agriculture and a treasury counselor who deals with the Ministry of Finance and the Central Bank and so forth. It is also, though, an extraordinary embassy because of the size and the presence of multinational forces, Iraq and General Petraeus's command and all of the many parts of that institution. We have daily contact with the ministries on policy issues and program issues. And oftentimes when you go to see Iraqi officials, you see other Americans coming out from the offices, and we have embedded advisors throughout the ministries in various capacities and depending on the ministry and what they want. We did have a commission, a Joint Economic Commission, and the last time it had met was 2005, in I think April in Amman. We have revamped and revised that into something called the Dialogue for Economic Cooperation, or the DEC. And we just 2 weeks ago had a meeting of the DEC, very successful. I had Undersecretary Reuben Jeffrey from the State Department, Undersecretary David McCormick from Treasury, a number of assistant secretary and other policy level officials from USTR and USDA and Commerce and so forth. And it was a highly successful. We had, in the opening meeting, we had 9 ministers, 2 days of meetings, a lot of working groups on issues like anti-corruption or banking reform. Very successful. We were very pleased with it. And we'll do that more. And the other exciting thing about it was in Baghdad. And a number of the policy officials we had from largely domestic agencies had not been to Baghdad before, and it represented how the changing security dynamic in Baghdad allows us to do more. And Ryan shares with me a real interest in doing more of our training and policy engagements in Baghdad. We just have a much bigger impact when we do that. Iraqis always welcome the occasion to go to Cairo or Amman or Dubai or Washington for training, but for each one person like that who can travel, there are 10 others who need the exposure to these dialogues, and we can now do them in Baghdad, and we're that is very much our standard operating procedure. It's exceptional when we try to undertake something outside of the country. On the technical service arrangements with the international oil companies, I'll try and be short on this so that I can come back to it if people want, because I've been paying a lot of attention to it. What the Ministry of Oil is trying to do is formalize a longstanding kind of mentoring relationship that the various majors have had with the North Oil Company and South Oil Company, and to pay for the services that they had been getting for free, and also to ask more from the international oil companies as a result. And what they anticipate is that there would be a partnership between mainly South Oil Company and the majors for specific fields, the supergiant fields, so Rumaila, Majnoon, West Qurna, and Kirkuk in particular. And they would, each company would do a partnership for a field. And BP, for example, would do a partnership for Rumaila, and they would have a dedicated team at a nearby Dubai, Amman, someplace like that, and working with a dedicated Iraqi team on the recovery and reservoir engineering problems of that particular field. And the BP or Shell or Chevron would actually acquire. One of the big problems the Iraqi oil ministry has is actually spending its money because oil equipment's in short supply these days with market prices so high, and they don't have the capacity to write the specs and get the, you know, have the relationships with the dresser industries and Halliburton and all these other kind of companies. And so they would actually acquire this equipment for these engineering projects. And one of the things that they're discussing is potential payment for these services in oil. What would happen would be they would owe the money, but that they would lift oil valued at the index price against the money. And that's one of the details they're working out, if it can be done. At this point, none of the majors are proposing to send expatriates into Iraq. They will be basically mentoring and working by computer link up with the people analyzing the 3D seismic and all that sort of stuff and helping make the determinations and then buying the goods. The Minister of Oil briefed the Council of Ministers 2 weeks ago, and he forecast that if all five of these TSAs are done and they proceed with the investment program that they anticipate spending $2.5 billion on revenue reservoir enhancement over a period of 2 years. Now, most of that is not going to be on the companies themselves. It's going to be on the equipment that the companies order on behalf of the ministry. So I think I'll stop there. As I say, we are anticipating those signatures shortly. They do not represent actual investment. The fields will be owned by the Ministry of Oil, and it's like hiring a consultant, but the consultant in question may be ExxonMobil or Shell or whatever. On jobs program, we certainly agree with you. Jobs programs are critical, and they're not the critical ones are not the short-term, short-term employment, because at some point the money for that runs out, or the capacity and tolerance for that runs out. We need short-term jobs programs that lead to something, and that's what we have been working on. The USAID Community Stabilization Program has about 70,000 Iraqis on short-term job contracts now, but importantly also has a vocational training element, and we're increasingly, the new CSP programs are vocational training, designing to teach people to be welders for factories and or learning specific skills. The Awakening, or the so-called Concerned Local Citizens, also has a jobs impact. There are 80,000 CLCs now, largely being paid by the U.S. military under the CERP program. We are very much seized with what is their future. And DOD has made a partnership program with the Ministry of Labor and Social Affairs called JTERP, which I'm not even sure I can remember what it stands for, Joint Technical Employment, I don't know, whatever JTERP stands for. And it is designed basically to teach skills and to do job placement programs and so forth for specifically for the CLCs. We can't do that with the USAID money because it's a security program. The CLCs are a security program, and we have our own legislative restrictions on that. I also totally agree with you about housing, where we are focused very much on housing. We haven't done much with housing for several years, but we are looking at ways to help the Iraqis analyze the problem of building new towns with this, this government-owned land outside of the major cities. I met to see the housing minister a week or so ago, and the finance minister who controls all the land. My vision of it, this is just my vision, is that we need to find a way to actually sell the land to Iraqis. If the housing program based on long-term leases doesn't really have the sex appeal to get people to invest in their own house, if you do it based on allocation or lease of government-owned land, then the government is going to have to build the housing units, which it is very bad at and slow. But if you can find a way to focus the government's resources on the provision of the infrastructure, the roads, the sewers, the water, the power, schools, and things like that, and then sell plots of land that at a price that is substantial enough that it represents an investment for a poor Iraqi, and I don't know what that number is, you know, $500 or $1,000, something like that, for a plot of land that represents a sacrifice, then if someone puts that kind of money into a plot of land, they're going to build something on it. You don't want to give it away, because then people might not build on it. And you don't want to price it so high that it's only an upper class kind of thing, because that doesn't solve your housing problem, and it also doesn't get built as fast. So we're working through these kinds of issues, and we hope that and the Iraqis are as well. Bahram Saleh is very seized with it, and we hope to have some new ideas of that kind in the near future.
Very good. Thank you. Raymond?
Oh, thank you. Raymond Gilpin, U.S. Institute of Peace. Thank you very much for your presentation. I'm very interested in the transition from bricks and mortar to sustainable economic growth. You'll agree that sustainable economic growth requires a reasonably stable macroeconomic climate.
Mm-hmm.
You referenced the IMF projection of 7% from last year, I think. Up from, I think, below
4.08. It's an 08 projection.
And FY08 projection. That is largely based on the assumption that the oil sector will pick up. Is there the danger that with oil prices rising, and if the sector does pick up, there might be an influx of cash into the economy, which could itself be inflationary? Iraq hasn't had that problem until mid last year. The economy was somewhat constrained because of the security environment. If we have the kind of transition that you're speaking of, and there's an uptake in economic activity, is there not a danger that the monetary authorities would have to deal with inflation as well, which could derail a lot of other issues? Secondly, you mentioned privatization. There are a number of privatization candidates that you referenced. I just hearken back to the immediate post-perestroika privatizations in Russia. And last week's Forbes billionaire list lists Moscow as the place with most billionaires in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Are we not, if we don't have the institutional framework right and the requisite financial and regulatory instruments for equitable and effective privatization, are we not setting Iraq up for very, very stark inequities as we see in Russian society, and could that in itself not undermine peace and stability?
Thank you. Two good questions. First of all, on the macro side and monetary policy, actually, Iraq has not gotten much attention or credit for the very substantial monetary stabilization policy that it has carried out successfully. In 2006, inflation was in the neighborhood of 65%, and there was a real risk of dollarization of the economy. The dinar was in question. A lot of transactions were moving to dollars. And with IMF help, Central Bank instituted and maintained a very tight monetary policy, moved towards appreciation of the dinar, and we now see inflation by the best measure, the core inflation measure, at about 12%. The most recent inflation numbers, if you take out energy and food, it's 4%, but I don't think that that's too useful to look at. So we actually have now consumer price index growth in the neighborhood of 12%, and the policy rate of the central bank, essentially its rediscount rate for lending to the banking sector, is 20%. So we have very substantial real interest rates, and by my view, it actually is excessive and is choking off the economic growth that might otherwise be there. it is true that Iraq is getting a lot of money from current high oil prices, and that the expenditure of that money could be inflationary if there were if it was being spent in markets, limited markets. What we've seen with the surge is we've seen actually a considerable liberalization of markets. We have trucking and imports that weren't happening before because of the surge, and so we're able to see a very substantial increase in government expenditures without adding to inflationary pressures. We also, one of the reasons inflation was so bad in 06, the first part of 07, is that the government was following the IMF's requirements for revaluing oil product prices. That has largely run its course. The product prices for oil are not as high as ours, but they are comparable to regional prices and actually above Iran's prices, so they're not losing oil products to smuggling outside of the country. I would like to see more liberalization of oil product prices. I would like to see the central bank start to cut the policy rate. It's done two cuts so far, in January 1% and in February 2%. So now the policy rate is down to 17. And it is being very, very conservative, paying attention to the inflation rate. On privatization, there is no privatization strategy. There is no privatization law. There is no plan for privatization of state-owned enterprises. What they are doing instead is something which I am not aware of anyone else doing with state enterprises on a broad scale. They are seeking investors to undertake production sharing agreements for the major and hopefully competitive state enterprises. They have done three of these for cement plants. Under this, a consortium, a private consortium, negotiates with the government to take over management and operation of a state-owned industrial plant for a period of years. In the cement cases, it's 15 years. The investment consortium invests in the improvement of the production and brings in expatriates or other good managers to manage it. And they, in the cement case, the plants are producing at 20% of their design capacity. They raise that production up to 60 or 70%. And they pay the government in kind. So the government is going to receive 35% on each one is negotiated, but between 30 and 35% of the output of the plant. And then the foreign or the investment consortia will take the rest and sell that and pay its expenses and make a return on its investment. This is a 15-year contract. At the end of the day, the asset reverts to the government if we get to the end of that day. Most people assume that what's going to happen is in 3 or 4 years the plant will be privatized and however that is organized. It is however, it looks a little bit like production sharing in the hydrocarbons business. It only will make sense for capital or for plants, industrial plants, where there is really a high potential for profitability that is not being exploited. It's not going to make sense for a textile plant or some of the other state enterprises. So it may be only a small proportion of the total assets that make sense to do that way, or the government's going to have to take a much smaller share than 35%. They are talking about doing a next tranche of things like that, including a petrochemical plant, a steel rebar plant, and some of the more competitive parts of the state-owned enterprise empire. And that's a good thing because they'll put more people back to work and increase production. But it is not a privatization program per se.
Charlie, do I understand you correctly then that there is no land privatization scheme in place? I mean, I ask this question because
no.
I know in other situations the mobilization of real estate into the market has been a major issue and one of the key steps in getting private economic activity going?
They may get there, but they're not there yet. They have the Iraqi government in the foreign investment law that they passed in 2006. It only anticipates foreign investment with long-term land leases.
Now, we've got a longish line, so I'm going to have to
shorten
ask people to be quick.
Great, will do. Thank you. Chris Skopek with International Medical Corps. We've also been making a similar transition in our work in Iraq. Instead of moving from bricks and mortar, we're moving away from the blankets and non-food item distribution, trying to focus more on the capacity building within the ministries that we work with. And we feel the timing is right, given that a few years ago these systems, these institutions were just not in place whatsoever to work with. However, there still remains a very significant service delivery gap that needs to be fulfilled before we can actually hand over the, you know, everything to the ministries that is required of them to deliver the services that are needed for the Iraqi people. The strategy that you're talking about, this transition, my question is so much of it depends on the Iraqi government stepping up and fulfilling their role. And we talk a lot about the increased resources that they've had over the past few years, and you quoted the numbers that shows really significant economic growth. How much were they involved in the design of the strategy? How supportive are they of it? And to what extent is the U.S. government putting pressure on them to really step up to bat, deliver these resources to their service delivery ministries, and really try to address the gap that exists? Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the work of IMC in Iraq. We're very appreciative of the very fine work that you're doing, and we hope that we can continue to partner with you in a lot of specific projects. On the question, the Iraqi government is very aware, certainly, of our concentration on budget execution. We talk to the Prime Minister about this at weekly meetings. We are all over the Minister of Finance. The budget, the 2008 budget, its formulation and its passage is, among other things, a benchmark, but also something that is a very, very high priority. As I mentioned, we have all these embedded advisors, and it is they are there to increase service delivery and help the Iraqi ministries step up. Are they doing it? Well, I mean, you know, the story is never as good as you'd like it to be, but that's what our focus is on.
Please. By happenstance, my name is Michael Miller, America's Development Foundation. By happenstance, my question is somewhat related, and that was to try to ask you to give us some insights into the budgeting process, because mm-hmm. we've always had this tradition of this top-down mm-hmm. budgeting process, central government to local mm-hmm. government.
Right.
Now, indeed, with through the PRTs, mm-hmm. we're really more focused on the local governments, helping them come up with their priorities and their things, but how responsive are you finding central government to making allocations based upon all that work being done in terms of the PRTs on the local government mm-hmm. level?
Well, the budget formulation process in Iraq is much like the budget formulation process anywhere, with the addition that before the 2006 budget year, there were virtually no expenditures made at provincial level at all. And in Saddam's time, everything was done by national ministries who had provincial level directors general. But there were no provincial councils. They didn't have any responsibility. And yes, we've worked with the provincial councils on the preparation of budgets and project lists. And we have a program called the PRDC. It's a Provincial Reconstruction Development Council program. We started back in 2006. And the idea was we would place a small amount of money, you know, $15, $17 million in a province, and have our PRT say to the provincial council, that had just been stood up, of course, the previous year, look, we're prepared to do small-scale projects totaling $17 million in Muthana or something like that. You have to figure out how we want to work with you in figuring out what your priorities are. And we taught them democracy in action, budget priorities. This has been a wildly successful program and actually developed the capacity to program, to think through, do I want one school in every kata, or do I want a big water supply and treatment plant, or how do I balance schools against healthcare centers? How do I deal with all these kinds of demands that are being placed on me by the folks who come in for the weekly provincial council meetings? And then we build them. You know, they specify them, and then the Army Corps of Engineers hires contractors, and we actually build them. It's actually a problem here because we don't spend the money fast enough. People say, well, why is there so much of a backlog in PRDC? Because actually for PRDC, spending the money is the least of it. What the importance is the process, teaching them how to budget, teaching them how to think through these kinds of things. So we actually feel quite comfortable that the budget success of the provinces in 07 was related to the experience that we gave them in 06. And we have helped them with budgets in 07 and 08, although these are essentially the province's own budgets and result from the political interplay that happens that way. We're having the same role, facilitating but not directive, with ministries. And the budget that was passed in January, actually in February, was developed in the summer of 07 with, you know, requests for budgets from ministries, and a lot of it, like budgets anywhere in the world, is based on what have I done last year, and I try and go for 10% more or whatever, and adding some sort of large capital budgets that they want to make. So you have the Ministry of Health wanting to build hospitals, you have the Ministry of Oil wanting to build refineries, you have the Ministry of Electricity wanting to build power plants, and that's the way it happens. And then it comes up and gets cut by the Minister of Finance, who says it's too much, we can't afford it, and they have imposed actually quite conservative revenue estimates for 2008, and they anticipate having a supplemental budget in the middle of the year.
Is the central government responsive to provincial council requests?
I'm sorry. Yes.
My question.
Yes. More than anyone anticipates, partially because the revenue situation is better than they had any right to expect. But yes, the central government gave the provinces a 30% increase in the aggregate in 08 over 07. And they did so because the provinces in 07 did better at spending the money than the ministries. And the Minister of Finance says if they're going to spend the money effectively, then let's give it more. And it's been also fair. It's not a formula based on population. So for the most part.
For what it's worth, when I was in Baghdad recently, I asked a lot about this process. And there was a real conviction that it was working and that it was fair. That is, distribution was more or less according to
population.
It's not sectarian.
It's really a remarkable story.
Please.
Corrine Haglund with National Journal Magazine. Could you talk a little bit about the central government's rate of expenditure last year and this year? As you know, there's a disagreement between state, treasury, GAO over mm-hmm. what exactly was spent last year. What mm-hmm. happened then, and what do you expect this year?
Well, without getting too deep into the numbers, let me, first of all, much of the attention to this, including the piece in the New York Times on Sunday, focused entirely on the capital budget. It neglects the fact that two-thirds of the Iraqi central government budget is spent for operations, salaries, normal operations of government. And those expenditures are executed almost like clockwork, 1/12 of the annual budget every month. And so when you look at the aggregate, you have a $41 billion budget. I think it's 28 or so $10 billion. So $31 billion of it is the operating budget, and that's all being spent. So you have to take that. You know, people are focusing as if the whole budget was the capital budget. The main part of the budget are the salaries and expenses of people doing the work of governing, and those are being paid currently and normally. On the capital budget, one of the things that happened in 2007 that totally messed up accounting is that in mid-year, the Iraqis, as a requirement of the standby arrangement in the IMF, adopted the IMF chart of accounts. And not to get too accounting lingo about it, but the chart of accounts changed the way that they reported their budget expenditures to the IMF and to everybody else. And instead of making a distinction between capital and operating budget the way they had budgeted it, they were required by the IMF to report by activity, so much for salaries, so much for financial assets, so much for non-financial assets. And that is the basis of the difference between the GAO and the administration about how much they're actually spending. The GAO said the only capital reconstruction activities that we can find are the reported non-financial assets expenditures of the government, which are these, if you will, buildings, a good way to think about it. And neglected the fact that if you're building a building, there is the salaries of the people that were building the building are now in the salaries account rather than in the capital account. They also, GAO's famous study that came out, I think, in October was based on data as of July and 407. And that's why they said that the total expenditures were 4%, something like that, of the capital budget of $10 billion. It was a data problem, a data timeliness problem, and just they didn't want to talk to us about this. They wanted to base their report on the actual numbers that were reported to the IMF. And as a result, that's the conclusion. Now, what happened? We think, we have gotten the Ministry of Finance to give us basic capital, make them restate their budget expenditures in 2007 based on the old definitions of capital and operating. And the latest numbers that we have, as of when I left Baghdad last week, were for the end of October of 07. This is not a computerized society. They don't have the kind of data immediacy that we do. But as of the end of 07, they had spent, I think it was $4.4 billion that was based on, and we were tracking three sets of similar things, the allocations to ministries and spending units by the Ministry of Finance, the planning ministry's approval for spending, and then the reported execution of spending. And all three of them tracked, at least the slopes were the same. They were a little bit different in time series. But the government is projected, and we agree, that when they close the books on 07, that the capital expenditures will be $6 billion or maybe a little bit more. And all of the data series that we can see through October, if you project out, will hit the end of the year at about $6
billion. But $6 billion
that's a projection.
Right? Out of $10 billion
budget. This
is
just the capital budget, so that's 60% execution. And that compares with 22% in 2006. But I promise not to get into too much detail. There's one more important difference. In 2006, the 22% figure did not include open letters of credit. 2007, the $6 billion figure on the basis of these reports that we've been getting from the Ministry of Finance do include open letters of credit. And the difference is not trivial. There are probably $1 billion to $2 billion in open letters of credit. These are letters of credit that are open for capital goods required for capital projects. So if the Ministry of Oil orders a new hydrocracker and spends $300 million for it, they open a letter of credit. The hydrocracker doesn't arrive for 18 months, but they are expensing the $300 million in the year that they spend it and they commit it into a irrevocable letter of credit on the quite logical basis that they don't have that money to spend on anything else. It's already with the Trade Bank of Iraq in an LC. And I'm sorry, that's too wonky an explanation.
You know, I can't help but remark that we have some of the same problems on a much smaller scale within USIP, showing the congressional staff is always looking for our burn rate, as ignominiously call it, and
right.
And
as if that's what you're doing,
and as if that's what we're doing, right? And it's always exceedingly difficult, even with all our computer systems, to give them anything like an up-to-date number. I can only imagine precision. How difficult it is in Iraq.
I would only just say precision is actually difficult for a variety of reasons, but there is no doubt about the trend. They are spending more money on capital goods, capital projects in 07 than in 06. 08 was off to a slow start because the budget didn't get approved until February, but we are trying to help them. And they have a big incentive to spend this year because the Ministry of Finance is going to run a supplemental budget in the summer, and you won't be eligible for participation in this supplemental budget process unless you spent your primary allocation.
This also reminds me of Washington, D.C. Please.
I'm Karen DeYoung with the Washington Post.
Yes, hi, Karen. How are you?
Hi. Going back to the first question, I appreciate that you don't want to discuss what happened before you got there, but it would seem to me that the fact that you keep getting asked about it is an indication of what the political reality is here, that
right.
people want to know what happened to the $18 billion just as a reconstruction budget. And I wonder, given that by the State Department's own reporting of service deliveries, electricity, water, and even job creation, you don't see those indicators rising very rapidly. What kind of time frame have you set for yourself, and what markers are you looking for in terms of things that people here can understand, as opposed to, as you said, the kind of complicated budget situation that you outlined? And secondarily to that same question, what kind of input do you have into decisions about security, given that so much of your program depends on improved security, and that seems to be the issue that is going to be up in the air certainly over the next year?
Well, on the first, I think, fair enough, and we do have reams and reams of reports about what we've done with the IRF $18 billion in terms of the water supplies delivered and the power plants renovated and so forth in great and excruciating detail. And we actually are, we haven't done a good enough job at explaining to the Iraqis what we've done. And I've actually commissioned a kind of a brochure for the Iraqis to explain to them what we've done, because it has a political impact. And we have been shy about doing that because we felt that if we identified a project as being one that had been done with U.S. funds, it would be a target for the insurgents. And we didn't want to see U.S. taxpayers' money being becoming targets. So there are sort of Iraq-specific reasons why we haven't done as good a job as we might on those kinds of dimensions. And there are some projects and power plants and things like that are still in train and are coming online this spring, just in time, we hope, for the summer power spike. And we can talk about those. And I know why people raise these questions in Washington. It's just that, I mean, I don't feel that it's something that I can really speak to, because I wasn't involved in those decisions, and I can't really say what was being thought at the time. And the times were different, indisputably different. You had between 2004 and 2007, you had in general a deteriorating security situation. Every month was worse than the month before. It was harder and harder to get contractors and people to work on and with Iraq. The opposite is happening now. And the security situation is getting better every month, and there's more interest in the international private sector, and there's more interest in the international community. And so we live in a different era and have different opportunities. I completely agree that we do need metrics to be able to determine how we're doing. One of the metrics we are using is budget execution. We are also looking at performance by ministries in partnership with us on projects that we agree together. I think I mentioned earlier that we used to just decide, and now we have to negotiate and agree together on what we're going to try and do. And the advantage of that is it actually smokes us out in terms of an agreement on what it is that the purpose of this enterprise is. When you have lots of money and essentially unilateral decision-making freedom, then you can just sort of do it and retrospectively decide what you were trying to do. We live in a different era, and I think that we will try to be much more specific about the individual things that we are doing. And obviously, we need to justify the use of the U.S. taxpayers' money to Congress, and that's one of the reasons I'm here this week.
What about the question of your input into security planning?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm sorry. I forgot about that. I raise sometimes issues to the multinational forces. One of the things I alluded to in the prepared remarks is the very troublesome recent or growing practice of targeted assassinations at technocrats that make the economy work. We've lost a deputy director for the statistical agency, one of the directors general, the critical directors general in the Ministry of Finance. A number of other senior officials have either been scared or kidnapped or assassinated. And the multinational forces is working with the Iraqi security forces to beef up security, whether it is more security details and armored vehicles or some intelligence work to try to figure out who's doing this. We are working on that. We are also, one of the things that puts Iraqi officials at risk is coming into the green zone, coming and going into the green zone. And so we're trying to find new ways to interact with them that doesn't require them to do that.
Please, one last question.
I'm Jim Mustin with Trauma Healing and Reconciliation Services, Charlottesville, Virginia. I'd like to know what your current assessment is of the infrastructure of Iraq and how that might differ from the infrastructure of Iraq at the beginning of the occupation.
Are things better or not?
Well, first of all, just what is the assessment of the way it is now? What is the infrastructure? How could you overall describe what you have?
The infrastructure, you mean systems like electricity and water?
Electricity, water, and the basics.
Yeah. We had the electricity system in Iraq was designed to service Baghdad. Power generation tended actually to be in the south and in the north where the oil and gas resources were or where the hydropower was. But the transmission grid was designed to move most of the power to Baghdad. Then a lot of the power generation facilities dated to the 80s, the last time that the Iraqis had a fair amount of money in the 70s, and they were aging, aging plants, often built by foreign contractors. The Koreans built several. Water was woefully inadequate, very little of it, the water supply to residences and city water was not treated, and there was very little sewage. It was a very strange society which supplied modern services for a very small elite of Saddam's inner circle and specific neighborhoods, and left the rest of the country pretty much to fend for itself. And it was very dilapidated. We are now just now above pre-war levels in electricity, and we're substantially above we're above pre-war levels in oil too, but just barely, and substantially above the levels we saw in 2004 and 2005 in both of those quantities. And the number of people getting city water is, I think, twice what it was. I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but it's better. It's clearly better, but the scale of the problems in the midst of an insurgency have been daunting. Is daunting. The scale is daunting. Right.
Charlie, let me ask you if you have anything you want to add.
No, I think you squeezed everything
wrap
out of
up. I think we have squeezed you pretty hard, and you've done an admirable job, and we thank you for it.
Thank you very much.
Call your name or your number.